It was just after noon on June 3, 2021, when traffic in uptown Minneapolis slowed around a public parking ramp. Unmarked vehicles had moved in quietly, part of a U.S. Marshals task force looking for Winston Boogie Smith, a 32-year-old man wanted on a weapons violation. Within minutes, gunfire echoed through the concrete levels. Witnesses ducked behind cars. Smoke hung in the air. When it cleared, Smith was dead inside his parked vehicle. There was no body camera footage. None of the officers involved were wearing cameras, and the surveillance video from the ramp offered no clear view of the final moments. Conflicting accounts spread fast. Some said Smith fired first, others insisted he was ambushed. The official reports would take months, but the city had already erupted again. In a place still raw from the murder of George Floyd a year earlier, another question cut through the crowd. Who do you believe when there's no record of what really happened? Chapter 1. The Chase. The day began like any other Thursday in early summer. The air over Minneapolis carried that thick June heat, sticky and restless. Downtown commuters filled the intersections by mid-morning. By noon, the rhythm of uptown was steady again, cafes full, traffic slow, music from parked cars blending into the hum. But inside several unmarked vehicles scattered through the area, officers from a federal task force watched one name on their radios: Winston Boogie Smith. Smith had been on their radar for months. The U.S. Marshals Service Fugitive Task Force had a warrant for him connected to a firearms violation. He was known locally, outspoken online, seen at protests, a father, and often in and out of legal trouble. That afternoon, surveillance units tracked a vehicle registered in his name moving near Lake Street. It wasn't a high-speed pursuit. They followed quietly, waiting for a moment that felt safe to move in. By 1:45 p.m., Smith's car turned into a public parking ramp above a busy restaurant block. The task force coordinated by radio. There was no public announcement of their presence, no marked police cruisers with lights or sirens. Officers were plainclothes, traveling in unmarked SUVs, each trained for high-risk warrant arrests, but under different agency protocols. Some were local deputies on loan, others federal. None wore body cameras. Inside the ramp, Smith parked his car and stayed seated. He had plans that day, a lunch nearby, then a studio session. At 2:05 p.m., two officers approached his vehicle. Witnesses later described hearing shouts, short, loud, commands that bounced off the concrete. Seconds later, the sound of gunfire ripped through the enclosed space. What happened in that window of time would become the center of months of investigation. Law enforcement accounts later stated that Smith fired first from inside his vehicle. They said he produced a handgun, prompting two task force officers to return fire. Smith was struck multiple times and pronounced dead at the scene. A woman in the passenger seat, his acquaintance that day, survived without major injury but was immediately taken into custody for questioning. But in the hours after the shooting, details were scarce. No body camera footage existed. The federal task force at that time did not require its members to wear cameras, even if they were state or local officers. The department policy that could have captured what happened had been suspended under a multi-agency agreement. This meant that the only immediate account came from the officers themselves and the few civilians nearby who heard the shots but saw little. Outside the ramp, police vehicles began blocking off intersections. Yellow tape went up around the entrance. Residents watched from balconies, recording short clips of the aftermath. Uniformed officers arriving, detectives carrying gear bags, paramedics working under a tarp. Some videos caught raised voices as bystanders asked what had happened. The word spread fast online: another man shot by police in Minneapolis. By 3 p.m., the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension had been notified. Its agents arrived to process the scene, tagging shell casings and photographing the vehicle. They collected Smith's gun, a handgun found on the driver's side. The agency stated publicly that it was loaded and appeared to have been fired. That initial announcement didn't quiet the anger growing outside the taped perimeter. People recognized his name. Winston Boogie Smith had posted videos just weeks earlier about police overreach. He had talked about feeling watched, about never getting the benefit of the doubt. Some of those clips began circulating again within hours, reshared as proof that he had predicted something would happen to him. At 4:30 p.m., local media set up near the ramp entrance. Reporters pressed officers for answers. Who fired first? Why were there no cameras? Could anyone verify the sequence of events? The early answers were cautious. Officials confirmed Smith's death, cited the active investigation and refused to release names of officers involved. The lack of footage immediately raised tension. By early evening, the intersection around Lake and Girard was filling with people. Word of the shooting had spread across social media. Some came carrying signs left over from previous demonstrations. Others simply stood in silence, staring toward the blocked-off structure. A makeshift memorial formed along the curb, candles, flowers, a handwritten note that read, "Another brother gone." Inside the ramp, the forensic team continued for hours. Technicians measured bullet paths, took samples from the car interior, and marked blood evidence on the pavement. The work went methodically, step by step, as outside the noise grew louder. Protesters shouted at the police line. Drivers honked passing by. Some local business owners closed early. By 9 p.m., police declared the area an active scene and expanded the perimeter. The crowd swelled again near midnight, lit by street lamps and phone flashlights. Chants echoed through the parking lot, names of victims passed, followed by Smith's. Officers held their positions, giving short warnings through megaphones. The tension carried deep into the night. Behind the scenes, investigators were already mapping the next steps. The Bureau of Criminal Apprehension would collect officer statements separately under state protocol. The federal task force, operating under U.S. Marshals' authority, was expected to cooperate but would maintain internal review rights. The complexity of overlapping jurisdictions meant that the case files could take weeks before a full summary was available to the public. At 1:10 a.m., most of the crowd dispersed. Only a few candles still burned near the ramp entrance. Inside, the forensic lights dimmed as evidence technicians packed up. The city around them was quiet again, but the question hung over everything. What had happened in that small space that afternoon, and why was there no clear record? Morning brought press conferences. City leaders expressed condolences. Federal spokespeople emphasized that Smith had fired first. Civil rights advocates demanded transparency. Reporters repeated the same question that would define the story. How could a shooting involving multiple officers in 2021 leave no body camera footage at all? The answer would trace back to policies written years earlier, agreements that allowed certain multi-agency teams to operate outside local camera mandates. Those rules had survived internal debate and political promises after George Floyd's murder. Now, less than 15 months later, the absence of footage in another deadly encounter reignited the city's grief and anger. Forensic investigators continued combing through Smith's car. They matched shell casings to both his gun and the officer's weapons. They reconstructed the timing of shots using audio captured from nearby security microphones. Each data point mattered. Each finding was another attempt to fill the gap left by the missing footage. As the day closed, Smith's family arrived to see the location. His sister cried quietly, standing behind the police tape. Reporters kept their distance as she placed flowers on the curb. "He was scared of this," she said softly to no one in particular. "He told me something like this would happen." The investigation was only beginning, but the community's verdict was already forming. In a city still marked by trauma, faith in any official explanation was fragile. The killing of Winston "Boogie" Smith would not fade quickly. It was a new chapter in an old question. Who decides the truth when the only people left to tell it are the ones who pulled the trigger? Chapter 2, The Fallout. The morning after the shooting, Uptown woke to a heavy silence. The ramp was still cordoned off, with yellow tape flapping in the early light. The acrid smell of gunpowder had faded, but the tension had not. Reporters crowded behind the barriers, cameras fixed on the entrance where officers moved quietly in and out. Minneapolis had seen this scene before, a line of uniforms, a press release, and a promise of transparency. But this time there was no video, no footage to study frame by frame. At police headquarters, the official statement went out just after 9 a.m. It confirmed that Winston "Boogie" Smith had been killed by members of a federal task force while they attempted to arrest him on a warrant. The release said he had produced a handgun and fired from inside his vehicle. Officers, it claimed, responded with deadly force. Beyond that, the document said little. It didn't name the officers, and it didn't clarify how many rounds were fired. It didn't explain the absence of cameras. By noon, local news stations were running continuous coverage. Screens flashed Smith's name and photo. On social media, his friends shared old videos of him laughing, cooking, and joking with his kids. Others reposted clips from his live streams where he had talked about distrust of the police. The contrast between the man seen online and the crime scene images circulating on the news deepened the confusion. Who was Winston Boogie Smith, a wanted felon, a father, a loud critic, or all of those things at once? Witness accounts added more noise. A woman who had parked one level below said she heard the shouting, but never saw Smith with a gun. Another claimed she heard officers yell, "Drop it," just before the shots. A few minutes of cell phone footage from the street captured the echoes of gunfire, then the chaos that followed, but it showed no detail of the shooting itself. That absence turned into fuel for speculation. By afternoon, protesters had returned. They gathered at the base of the ramp with signs and candles, chanting Smith's name. Some held photos of George Floyd, tying the two cases together in spirit. Others brought loudspeakers, demanding the release of all evidence. For many, it wasn't about believing one version over another. It was about the pattern. Unarmed or armed, guilty or not, the end result seemed the same. City officials tried to strike a careful tone. The mayor issued a short statement calling for patience and peace, promising a full investigation by the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. But few in the crowd believed patience would bring clarity. Reporters noted that this was not a city starting from zero trust. The past year had left deep scars. Minneapolis had become a symbol of both reform and fatigue. Each new death reopened the wound. That evening, the passenger who had been with Smith spoke briefly through her attorney. She confirmed that she had been in the car, that officers approached suddenly, and that she ducked when she heard shots. She said she never saw Smith holding a gun, but admitted she couldn't see everything once she dropped down. Her words spread quickly, reshared across platforms. Within hours, the narrative had split wide open, law enforcement's version against the woman's. The Bureau of Criminal Apprehension began its work with quiet precision. Agents collected all shell casings, trajectory data, and residue samples. They confirmed the recovery of a handgun from the driver's seat. Ballistics matched that weapon to spent casings found near the vehicle, supporting claims that Smith had fired. But the sequence, who fired first, how quickly, under what conditions, remained unverified. Without body camera footage, investigators had to rely on physical evidence, radio logs, and witness statements that conflicted in tone and timing. Meanwhile, community organizers met at a local church. They planned nightly gatherings near the scene and called for federal oversight. Their demand was specific: require body cameras for all agencies working in Minneapolis, regardless of jurisdiction. The message spread far beyond the city. National civil rights groups picked up the story, framing it as a case study in the failure of transparency. By the third day, the block near the parking ramp had turned into a vigil site. Murals appeared on concrete walls. Messages written in chalk read, "We need proof," and "No more blind justice." A local artist painted Smith's face on a nearby utility box, surrounded by the words, "Who watches the watchers?" Television crews filmed interviews with passersby, many saying they didn't need to see footage to believe what had happened. Others urged caution, worried that conclusions were forming before evidence was tested. Behind closed doors, investigators sorted through reports. They reconstructed the timeline down to the minute. Radio logs showed the call to move in at 2:04 p.m., followed by a brief exchange before shots were fired. The total time from contact to fatal injury was under a minute. In that gap, an entire city's faith in accountability was tested again. Smith's family released their own statement through an attorney. They demanded that the Department of Justice open a civil rights investigation, arguing that federal oversight was necessary given the multi-agency nature of the task force. They also questioned why the public was being asked to take the officer's word without visual confirmation. Their lawyer cited inconsistencies between past cases where body cameras had been required for local officers, but not for federal ones. The tension reached another flashpoint when a federal spokesperson clarified that the task force had, in fact, barred body cameras at the time of the shooting. The policy was under review, they said, but had not yet been updated. That admission, that an operation conducted in a city still mourning George Floyd was carried out without cameras, fueled outrage. The next evening's protest swelled into the hundreds. Police stood in lines around the perimeter as speakers addressed the crowd. "We were told reforms were coming," one activist shouted through a megaphone. "How can you reform something that hides what it does?" The crowd answered in rhythm, chanting Smith's name until their voices echoed across the ramp. In the following days, city leaders faced reporters again. Questions turned from what happened to how it could keep happening. Why had camera policies been delayed? Who had authority over federal task forces operating on city streets? Each answer seemed to lead to another layer of bureaucracy. The agencies involved, U.S. Marshals, Hennepin County deputies, local police, each pointed to different oversight rules. Accountability was spread thin across jurisdictions. For investigators, the pressure was immense. Every piece of forensic evidence had to withstand public scrutiny. Lab technicians double-checked residue swabs, fingerprint matches, and projectile paths. The Bureau of Criminal Apprehension's lead investigator noted that while the evidence supported the presence of Smith's firearm, it could not independently verify his intent. Gunshot residue, after all, could indicate proximity as much as firing. The nuance was lost in public debate. As the second week passed, Uptown remained on edge. Protests continued nightly but had grown more organized. Food tables, volunteer medics, and cleanup crews appeared. Musicians played songs dedicated to Smith and others who had died in police encounters. The city's grief took the shape of ritual. Yet inside government offices, officials drafted memos about potential reforms. By late June, the U.S. Marshals Service quietly announced a new directive. All federal task forces working with local officers would now allow body cameras. The change was immediate and direct, an attempt to prevent another case like Smith's. But for many, it felt too late. On June 18th, a press conference was held by Smith's family. His mother spoke first. Her voice was calm but steady with pain. "They say my son fired a gun," she said. "They say a lot of things. But I will never see what happened. I will never know the truth." She paused. "And that's what hurts the most." The crowd of reporters lowered their cameras as she stepped back. Her words became the defining statement of the case. Not just a mother's grief, but a summary of the city's dilemma. When transparency fails, trust collapses. By the end of the month, the Bureau's preliminary findings were ready. The report confirmed that Smith had fired a weapon, that two task force officers returned fire, and that their actions were consistent with federal use of force policy. It also stated clearly that no video evidence existed. The case, from an internal standpoint, was considered closed. Publicly, though, the story was far from over. Activists planned a march for the one-month mark. The investigation's conclusion only deepened the divide between official record and public belief. To some, the report proved the system protected its own. To others, it was the only evidence available in an impossible situation. The night before the march, candles once again lit the base of the parking ramp. People stood in silence. The hum of traffic mixed with the sound of someone quietly singing an old gospel tune. A small boy tugged at his mother's hand and asked why everyone was sad. She knelt beside him and whispered something he couldn't quite hear. When she stood again, her eyes stayed fixed on the ramp's upper floors, the same place where weeks earlier, a brief burst of gunfire had changed everything. Chapter 3. The Questions Left Behind. By July, the flowers at the base of the ramp had wilted, but the questions still hadn't faded. The official report was out, the case formally closed, but Minneapolis wasn't finished talking about Winston Boogie Smith. His name had become part of the city's vocabulary, said at rallies, printed on banners, written on the walls of bus stops. Each conversation circled the same point. How could so much happen with so little proof left behind? Investigators had moved on to other cases, but for journalists and residents, the story was just beginning to settle into memory. Reporters filed follow-up features tracing every agency involved in the operation. They mapped the chain of command. The U.S. Marshals Service, local deputies assigned to the task force, and the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension called in after the fact. Every line of responsibility pointed somewhere else. No one person had full ownership of what happened in that ramp. The Justice Department reviewed the case briefly and declined to open a federal civil rights inquiry, citing insufficient evidence to contradict the findings already on record. That decision angered activists and legal observers alike. Without body camera footage, there was no way to independently verify either version of events. The woman in the car had given her testimony. The officers had given theirs. Beyond the ballistics data, there was only silence. Community meetings continued in church basements and libraries. People shared stories about past encounters with police, about promises of reform that seemed to fade once headlines moved on. Policy experts attended some sessions, trying to explain how task forces operated across state and federal lines. It was technical, written agreements, liability shields, camera rules that shifted depending on who paid the officer's salary that week. To the people in those rooms, it sounded like a system designed to hide behind its own paperwork. By midsummer, a new federal policy went into effect. The Justice Department now required officers serving on federal task forces to wear body cameras during arrests and searches. Officials cited the Minneapolis case as one of several that pushed the change forward. In Washington, it was seen as progress, a fix born out of tragedy. In Minneapolis, it felt like a concession too late for the man already gone. On Lake Street, the parking ramp was still there, open again to the public. The only sign of what had happened was a small mural tucked along the lower level, painted by local artists. It showed Smith's face surrounded by the words "Transparency is protection." Tourists sometimes stopped to take photos without knowing the story. For those who lived nearby, it was a quiet reminder of how fragile accountability could be. Smith's family filed a civil lawsuit that fall, seeking damages and disclosure of all internal communications about the operation. Their attorney argued that the agencies involved had violated state transparency laws by withholding key documents. The suit would take years to move through the courts, but its purpose was as much symbolic as legal. "We want someone to say this wasn't right," the lawyer said at a press conference. "Even if they can't bring him back." The city's conversations about reform kept returning to one word: trust. Community groups asked for a public registry of all joint task force operations. Lawmakers debated bills that would make local body camera policies binding even on federal partners. Some proposals passed, some didn't. The bureaucracy remained thick, but the pressure stayed constant. Through the summer, activists held small gatherings each week, no longer mass protests, but circles of discussion. They invited teachers, clergy, and city officials. They spoke about patterns, about trauma, about the human cost of systems designed for control rather than service. One speaker, a young man who had known Smith through community work, summed it up in one sentence: "Every time they say it's an isolated incident, we lose another piece of ourselves." Meanwhile, reporters kept digging. Public records requests revealed the long delay in updating federal camera policy, despite early drafts circulating months before the shooting. Internal memos showed that some local officers had expressed discomfort about the no-camera rule, but were told it was standard procedure. The revelation added another layer to public frustration: the idea that individuals inside the system had seen the problem but were powerless to fix it. By autumn, the pace of coverage slowed. National outlets had moved on to other stories, and the city had entered another cycle of elections and budget hearings. Yet every few weeks, Smith's name resurfaced, during council debates, in editorials, in the voices of callers on community radio. Each time, the focus shifted from his death to what it revealed: how fragile the line between law enforcement and public faith had become. When winter arrived, uptown looked different. The memorial at the ramp had been cleaned up, the chalk messages washed away by rain. Only the mural remained, its paint slightly faded, but still visible. On the anniversary of his death, a small group gathered there again. They lit candles and said prayers. There were no speeches this time, just silence and the faint sound of cars passing below. One of the organizers, a woman who had been at nearly every protest since June, stood apart from the group for a moment. She watched the lights flicker against the mural and spoke softly to a reporter nearby. "People think we protest because we hate the police," she said. "But that's not it. We protest because we want them to tell the truth, all of it. Every time." Her words echoed the heart of the case. The death of Winston "Boogie" Smith had exposed not only a moment of violence, but also the machinery of omission that surrounded it. It had shown how gaps in policy could become gaps in justice, and how a missing video could erase certainty for everyone involved. In the end, the official version of events remained unchanged. The task force maintained that Smith fired first. The Bureau of Criminal Apprehension closed its file. The lawsuit moved slowly through the courts. But for the people who lived in that city, none of it felt settled. The story had become something larger: a question about power, proof, and who gets to define the truth. As the last candle burned down, the group packed up their signs and headed toward their cars. The streetlights flickered overhead, throwing long shadows across the pavement. From the upper level of the ramp, a security guard leaned on the rail, watching quietly as the crowd dispersed. For a brief moment, the city was still again, caught between what had happened and what it still refused to forget.